Yeah, baby. Yeah, baby. Let's ask the inspector. And my name is Jeff Norman, and I'm with the inspector himself. Amazing how that works out just about every time. There he is, Scott Ritter. And we do the lightning round usually on Tuesdays, but Wednesday this week. And this is the show in which Scott answers questions from the audience in 3 minutes or less. And then on Friday nights, usually, we do the loquacious version of Ask the Inspector. And this week, we'll be doing that on Sunday night rather than Friday night. So it was for a very important reason that we switched from Tuesday to Wednesday. Are we going to tell our beloved audience what that important reason was, Scott?
Well, just a simple administrative function, picking up the visas so that my daughter and I can go to Russia. So we have successfully accomplished that task.
All right. Simple. That's an understatement, but sometimes less is more. And Russia is on. You have the visa. Fantastic. And
now we got to get on the airplane.
Now you got to get on the airplane. And now we have to make a film and organize a campaign around it and get a new nuclear disarmament treaty. And we are asking folks to help us with that effort. And we've set up a page for funds specifically for that project. If you would like to donate, we'd appreciate it. It's wagingpeace.fund. Waging Peace being the working title of the film.
Renee. Yes, Renee, I have the correct computer today. Jeff has made it clear that he would cancel all Ask the Inspector efforts if I fail to adhere to the simplest technical requirement. So
I like when you, it's amazing to me the things you notice. These are the comments that we didn't insert, but you see over in the, here in the Substack, not Substack, where are we? We're on StreamYard. In the StreamYard studio.
The studio.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, but actually the audio does seem a little funky today. Maybe that's why the question was asked.
No, I am literally on the right computer.
But no, I believe you. I believe you.
Audio says.
Yeah, sometimes there's many things that can go wrong.
I got the echo checked. I got the volume all put up.
Okay.
Automatically does mic volume is off.
Okay, that's the best
check,
we can
check,
do.
Check. This is like a pilot checklist coming in for landing, you know?
Check. All right. That's the best we can do. Okay, so before we get to the questions from our beloved audience, you wrote essentially a book. I mean, you know, I don't know how many of you folks are familiar with Scott's Substack. This guy's a prolific writer. Some posts are more involved than others, but the last few were quite extensive. You put this whole series together. It's like a book. We didn't even talk about it. You just did it all of a sudden. And this is the final chapter. What would you like to say about this that might lure folks over there to take a look and read it? Oh, and before you do that, let's acknowledge that Sam Poling illustrated that for us, and hopefully he'll be doing some more work for us. That might be a kind of a series of cartoons called The Inspector.
Yeah, Sam is a talented man. This was done on relatively short notice. I think he did an outstanding job. Some humor, some talent, and I think it adds to the article. And I hope to be able to twist his arm. I mean, he lives under my roof, so if he fails to perform, I have ways of you know, exerting influence and pressure. But
required. Yeah. We call him a tenant, or is he more family?
He's a fiance. So he is attached to my daughter. Therefore, I am.
Choose your words carefully. Go ahead.
No. I am choosing because I got to, you know, I understand that sometimes I say things and, no, I mean, Sam is family. Sam is here. And I was trying to be funny, but sometimes I realize when I say things, they can be taken the wrong way. So I decided not to be funny, and we'll just deal with the fact that, Sam is my daughter's fiance, and, he's a very talented young man. And I've known for some time that he has a proclivity for drawing. He's clever, and this was an opportunity to get him involved. I give Jeff Norman full credit because he's the one who came up with the idea of doing something like that. And then I said, well, you know, you've defined a round hole. I have a round peg. We can stick in it. And unfortunately, Sam said he's ready to he's ready and willing to do that. So I hope everybody appreciates it, and I hope it is part of a ongoing part of what we do.
I hope so too. Let us know what you think, folks.
So now, on the
about the article before we get to the questions.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm going to be honest. My short articles tend to do better. I mean, that's what frustrated me, is that I put a whole bunch of effort into this, because people are always asking. You remember the controversy we had about Game Changer?
Yeah.
All right. I've been accused of the great flip-flop on Iraq. You know, Scott, when you resigned, you said this, but then later on you said this. You know, and I see an inconsistency. And I said, well, I see actually history, meaning that, you know, things change, that circumstances change. And so I called this the making of an activist, because I transitioned from being probably the most hard-nosed weapons inspector, not probably, the most hard-nosed weapons inspector there was in Iraq. I was a son of a bitch. I was in your face, alpha dog, pee on the wall kind of guy. And but I was always fair. I always did the job in accordance with the mandate. But anybody that thought that I was soft on Iraq didn't know me at the time. I just wasn't. And I was for aggressive inspections. I was for aggressively getting our mandate done. The mandate was disarmament, not regime change. But I believe that Iraq needed to be held to account. I was not soft on Iraq. I believe that Iraq didn't cooperate with the weapons inspectors. We should blow them off the face of the earth. It's that simple. Again, people misconstrue me. They think I'm a pacifist. There ain't no pacifism here. All right. There's time for war. And I believe that a Chapter 7 resolution that calls Iraq's continued retention of prohibited weapons of mass destruction capability, despite all the efforts of the United Nations to disarm them, that's a provocation worthy of war. And so I talk about how the circumstances led to my resignation and my testimony before the United States Senate, and how the United States government tried to shut me down. So that covered the first, two big chapters. And the third one was the transition from, weapons inspector to activist, and how it happened. And in short, the reason I hope people understand that a lot of thought and effort went into this series, a lot of thought and effort. And I start with my resignation, which is based upon an inspection or attempted inspection of a site in Baghdad, the Adamiya Ba'ath Party headquarters. And I talk about how we, got that intelligence from the British and what led up to the inspection, et cetera. This final part, I explain that that intelligence was sensitive human intelligence, that when we received it, had a very limited shelf life, very limited, as in we have to inspect now. And that now was supposed to be in July. And I talked about how the U.S. and the British government dilly-dallied. And so August was, when we went in August, that was literally at the tail end of the viability of this, because according to that intelligence, the Iraqis would rotate this stuff out of the site. And so it would come into a given site, stay there for a little while, and then they would rotate it to a new site. So in August, we were literally at the tail end of, could this stuff even be there? There's a chance that it wouldn't have been there because we waited a long time. But August was it. That the MI6, the British intelligence said, that's it. We can't guarantee anything beyond August. And then they cancel the inspection. So to me, that target's dead. No sense in talking about it anymore. And I find out in December that target is the big target for the December inspection. And that's when the alarm bells went off. I'm like, well, wait a minute. This is going back to March of 1998, when the United States put the Ministry of Defense on the inspection list deliberately to provoke a war. And fortunately, I was the chief inspector, and I was able to convince the Iraqis to let me do the inspection. So we prevented a war. And again, people say, well, that's because, you're soft on Iraq. And no, it's because I believe in arms control. I believe in the mandate, and the Ministry of Defense had nothing to do with my mandate. So I just wanted to get that inspection done so we could get on to the task of finishing the job. to put this inspection site on this, on this site was just said that this is a provocation. They're deliberately trying to provoke Iraq into rejecting the inspection. For what purpose? Basically what we had in March, to go to war against Iraq. And so I talk about this. I talk about how this came to be, my interactions with Charles Dulfer, who Charles Dulfer is. I think I expose in this the fact that he worked for the CIA's Iraqi Operations Group, which is a covert team put together by the CIA for regime change. So the deputy director of UNSCOM works for the CIA's regime change team. I hope that sinks in right now to everybody. I talk about Richard Butler being just an absolute servant of Madeleine Albright, doing anything and everything. Sandy Berger, they pick up the phone, they say jump, he says how high, and how they sold out the mandate that I believed in, that I executed faithfully for 7 years. They sold it out. And in doing so, they set up an inspection that was designed to create a provocation. And in the end, the inspectors were ordered out by the United States, and the United States bombed Iraq for 72 hours, Operation Desert Fox. And at that point in time, it became clear to me that this whole inspection regime was corrupt to the core, that it didn't exist to disarm Iraq anymore, it existed to facilitate America's imperial ambition. And I called out Richard Butler, calling for his resignation, et cetera. And so I think if you read this article, I mean, and I went into great detail, I held nothing back. Some of the stuff, frankly speaking, people would say, maybe they'll say it doesn't show you in the best light. I don't give up, because the job isn't to put me in the best light. The job is to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Lay it all out there and let you guys decide, what you think about it, because you aren't going to find any different facts. The facts that are laid out there are the facts, everything in black and white.
History, and it's very interesting. I just want to, sorry to interrupt, but I just want to say, I know what you mean when you say you deserve more attention or some sort of a bigger payoff, in essence, given the effort that went into this. And that's actually what I was alluding to earlier when I said there really was no discussion about this. You just all of a sudden did it. And I think that the reason it's not getting more attention is because people haven't really been told about it. If you're going to read a book, you're in a certain frame of mind. You know it's a book, and you expect it to be a certain length. If you're just reading the next post, on some blog, you're not expecting it to be that long. So to the audience, I would say, go into this knowing that this is a four-part series, and it all adds up to something close to book length. I mean, not quite that much, but close to it. So go into it knowing that. It's history, and it's very interesting, and it's a great read.
Well, thank you very much. No, I mean, my goal, and it's not always going to be met, but my goal is to publish a more substantive article on Monday in time for the Tuesday show. And then the article that would be published on Thursday or Friday would be more about breaking news, more of a quick, quick strike article. So something's happening, relevancy, topicality, et cetera. But for instance, on Monday, I plan on writing something in honor of Daniel Ellsberg, because starting Monday is, starting the 24th is, Daniel Ellsberg week. It's something that's been agreed to by the friends and colleagues of Daniel Ellsberg. Just so if people don't know, he's been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and he is literally on his deathbed. It's very sad, very tragic. He sent out an email where he said that he was not going to seek chemotherapy. So he's in hospice, and he's with his family. But the idea now is, while he's still able to focus, that we were, his collective friends are going to spend a week appreciating him. An organization that I'm a member of, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, just awarded him their Sam Adams Award for integrity and such, for whistleblowing. And I mean, he deserves it for the Pentagon Papers. This isn't just a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Academy Awards. I mean, this is like, this would be the equivalent of the best actor ever. this, you know, the best whistleblower ever is Daniel Ellsberg.
He set the standard.
And what a standard it is. I mean, again, I always bring it up to people because sometimes people like, you know, make an effort to compare me to him. He has done that. I mean, I'm honored. But, you know, I always say that, you know, Daniel Ellsberg walked up court steps and asked the question, aren't you worried that you're going to go to jail? And his answer to me is just the best answer in the world. You know, wouldn't you go to jail if you could stop a war? Mm-hmm. Wow. Because I have to be honest with you. I think I've said this before. If I knew everything that was going to happen to me about, you know, when I made the decision to resign, I cannot sit here and guarantee you. I mean, I'd like to believe I'd have done the right thing, but I can't guarantee you that because there's a lot to think about. Here's a man who said, yeah, I'm willing to take that step. I'm willing to go that direction because when you go to jail to stop a war.
Batting an eyelash.
Without even hesitating. So that's Daniel Ellsberg. That's the gold standard. And that's what I aspire to every day to try and live up to that.
All right. With that, let's get to the questions from our beloved audience. 3 minutes or less. And if you ever go over 3 minutes, it's a very painful whip. So Scott is under strict orders to stick to that time limit. So we get as many questions in as possible. Starting with James from Moscow. In the past few days, I've seen many recruiting posters going up here in Moscow, even at little man kiosks, offering careers in the military. Is this part of Russia's long-term buildup or a need for soldiers right now for a major operation?
I mean, that's I haven't seen the posters. I did see somebody posted a commercial that the Russians have put out, a recruiting commercial for contract soldiers. That's the equivalent of American professionals. So we don't have conscription here in the United States. Russia has conscription, but the vast majority of their military is contract soldiers who sign a contract for a period of time to serve, you know, as professionals. It's a cool commercial. I mean, America could do well to mimic that, showing just men at work, everyday jobs, taxi driver, a security guard at a grocery store. I forget what the third guy was doing, but he was lifting weights. So I guess he just lifted weights for a living. But but then they suddenly put them in uniform and everything, and then they show them. It's a very effective commercial. Look, that's not how you recruit for an ongoing operation. End of story. The way you recruit for an ongoing operation is to have already recruited. So they're behind the power curve. That's the case. No, what happened here is that Russia expanded its military from 900,000 to 1.5 million. And they say that 70% of that, 60 to 70% of that new expansion is targeted to be done by contract soldiers. And so there is a push now to get contract soldiers to come in, not necessarily for the special military operation, but to form the new units that are going to be created. For instance, there's a 5-division corps, 70,000 men approximately, that's being built up just north of St. Petersburg in the Karelia area. And that has to be built from scratch. And that's where these contract soldiers come in. And so that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a nationwide push to get more contract soldiers into basically build up the Russian army by 600,000 as soon as possible. And the expansion of NATO, bringing Finland in, the aggressive stance of Japan, all of these, you know, give credence to Russia's need to build up its armed forces.
Sometimes in life, all you need is a letter. T from Germany. There now is talk of Ukraine fully mobilizing their country, 5 million people, after their upcoming counteroffensive. Assuming the U.S. can keep the Zelensky government in power after total mobilization of Ukraine, how could Russia react other than with nukes?
I mean, by beating Ukraine. I mean, how do you react? Russia's not going to use nuclear weapons. I don't know why people can't get it through their thick skulls, and I don't mean to insult T. I'm not saying your skull's thick. I'm saying other people who ask similar questions. Russia will not use nuclear weapons first. So 5 million, you know, Zulu, this could be Zulu Dawn, 5 million Ukrainian Zulus storming over the ridge, charging the brave line of British redcoats. You just keep pulling the trigger till they all die. That's what's going to happen. Russia will keep pulling the trigger till they all die. that's what I get for trying to be Zulu. The fact of the matter is, they're not going to get 5 million. You need 5 million uniforms. Where are you going to get that? You need 5 million weapons. Where are you going to get that? You need ammunition for those 5 million weapons. You're going to need sustainability. I mean, the idea, the notion that you're just going to full mobilize with what? Literally with what? What tanks are you going to give them? What armored vehicles? What artillery are you going to give them? What anything are you going to give them? I mean, Ukraine has nothing left. Nothing. And so suddenly they're just going to spit out 5 million people and train them? On what training ground? You're going to send them all to Europe? You think Europe's going to absorb 5 million Ukrainians? It's absurd. Ukraine will not total mobilize. It isn't going to happen. Politically, it can't happen. But they just can't absorb that number of troops. It's an absurdity beyond belief.
Okay. Let's move on to the next question. Maria Nizi Rocky from London. Mobilized soldiers take time to retrain, and Russia now has the extra 300,000 plus soldiers. So for emergency, why doesn't Russia mobilize another 500,000 to retrain and state that they will be sent home as reserves after training? This way, the public will be agreeable, and Russia will have a trained million plus army for Ukraine if needed or in case NATO joins in. Maria's thinking. What do you think about Maria's concept there?
I think Maria's brain is working, but it's harder than you think. First of all, training the 300,000 partial mobilization was not easy. Russia hadn't tested out mobilization of this nature ever in its recent history, and so going from theory to reality shook out the cobwebs. They learned a lot. And so the next time they mobilize, they'll do a better job of it. But there, you have to remember that when you mobilize men, you're taking them from a job. And there's a lot of jobs out there. And it's like anything. I mean, if you do anything too fast, if you accelerate anything, you're taking shortcuts, etc. There's people that are going to college. You need a certain amount of college-educated people to enter the workforce as professionals, et cetera. And when you start pulling people out of college to become mobilized, you disrupt that. And so there will be a price paid by the economy. You're pulling workers, so the economy would stall. Everything's done with a balance. And so in an ideal world, that might be something for the future for Russia to talk about. Because there was talk, for instance, they have an organization called BARS. Don't ask me to give you the Russian of that, BARS, but it basically deals, it's a sort of like an active reserve, sort of like what the U.S. military has, an active reserve. So soldiers who leave active service can join a BARS unit, and you can drill on a regular basis, you're organized. And so there are these BARS units that are out there fighting in the special military operation. But that was a experiment done. I think it was limited only to the Southern Military District. It wasn't done, throughout throughout Russia. It has its pluses and its minuses. But I think Russia's learning. And I think that, Mary, I think once this special military operation's over, I think you're going to see Russia move towards a large active reserve, just so they don't have a situation like that. An active reserve where men and women, say, hey, I'm here, I'm earmarked, I train, I know what unit I belong to. We train on that equipment regularly. And in time of mobilization, the laws are in place that these people can be unplugged, plugged in, and there's compensation in ways, so it's done in a way to lessen the shock on the system. But you can't seek 500,000 reserve, to train 500,000 reserves at the same time you're expanding your military by 600,000 to meet the 1.5 million cap. So I think we're going to see Russia do one thing at a time.
A worried father in Queens needs your advice, Scott. Alex Mandel. I agree with your assessment of the Ukraine situation, and it concerns me. I have a son finishing high school who is focusing on joining the Marines. I'm really bothered by this, especially with the direction that this country is going in with regard to Ukraine, China, etc. Please guide me about my son's decision. By the way, we are an Orthodox Jewish family.
Well, first of all, in terms of being Orthodox Jewish, I mean, the Marine Corps has certain, you know, when you join the Marines, you're a Marine. He'll be allowed to practice his faith, but, you know, there are no, there's no Sabbath, you know, especially in war. So there's that issue. Yeah, what I tell people about the Marine Corps is that, first of all, it's not for everybody. I mean, one of the great recruiting posters was when I was looking at the Marine Corps back in the 70s. It's a drill instructor right in the face of this this recruit, and the recruit looks scared to death. The drill instructor has the worst face in the world, and he's just yelling at him, and you know it's loud, and you know it's profane. And it says, "We never promised you a rose garden. You're damn right we didn't." You know, and then another one was, "If everybody could be a Marine, then there wouldn't be Marines." You're damn right. The Marine Corps is special. It's special because we have high standards, physical standards, intelligence standards, ethical standards, and then we subject you to the harshest training imaginable, and we shape you into a Marine. We remove your individuality, and you become part of a team. And then later on, as you join up with the Fleet Marine Force, you will develop, you know, your version of a Marine, but it will always be a Marine. So first of all, it takes a special kind of person. So your son has to ask the question, does he have what it takes to be a Marine, and does he want to be a Marine? Because that's the only question that needs to be answered right now. Do I want to be a Marine? Because what happens when you join the Marine Corps is your life is no longer yours, straight up. You belong to the country. You belong to the Corps. And whether you're blessed with peace or you're cursed with war, you will do what the Marine Corps tells you to do, as long as it conforms with the Constitution. It's a lawful order. And you'll do it regardless of the commander in chief. There's people who say, "I would never serve under Joe Biden." Then don't join the Marine Corps, because right now Joe Biden is the commander in chief, which means when he gives the order, you have to obey. You don't get to debate it. "I only will serve with Ronald Reagan." See, I was a Ronald Reagan kind of guy because I didn't like Jimmy Carter. But then Reagan left. I had George Herbert Walker Bush for a moment. Then Clinton came in. I did not like Bill Clinton, but he was my commander in chief. And so I had to salute smartly and obey, and I wasn't allowed to criticize. I did my job. You don't work for the president of the United States. You work for the people of the United States, who select a president, and then the president is your commander in chief, regardless of the political party. You are an implementer of policy. You're not a formulator of policy. You don't get to pick the war you fight in. You know, you don't get to say, "I only want to go across the beach in Normandy freeing France." Sometimes you get sent to Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria or Yemen, and you will do the damn job because you're a Marine. The Marine's job isn't to think about the larger political problem. That's the job of the politicians, who are held accountable to the people. The Marine's job is to faithfully execute the orders given to him or her. And if your son has any problem with that, then you shouldn't join the Marine Corps.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time, and you won't even be able to get into what it would be like to serve under President Kennedy Jr.
The same as it would be under Joe Biden. You serve.
All right. Not exactly the same. Your obligation would be the same, but it wouldn't be the same, because you would have different situations, right?
Yeah, but don't get to pick your situations. So.
Okay. Philip from Florida. Recently, Prigozhin wrote an article. Assuming you've already read it, what are your thoughts, in particular, over Prigozhin's feared shady deal between the U.S. and Russia? Have you read the article, Scott?
I have not, so therefore I can't answer the question.
All right. Aiden from Normandy. A rumor that started in a Greek newspaper, then picked up on Telegram, then picked up by Pepe Escobar, says that Russia has inflicted a strike from a supersonic Kinzhal missile on a command center of the NATO in Ukraine at a depth of 130 meters. There is talk of huge losses among NATO officers. Do you know anything about this?
I don't know anything about this, but I can say the following. The idea that NATO would take a large number of officers and put them on Ukrainian soil underground to do a job is stupid. Why would you do that? The job can be done above ground in more comfort in Poland. There's no reason for NATO to put a command post or a command center in Ukraine. So right off the bat, I just say that's the dumbest thing in the world. It wouldn't happen too. Back in the battle for Mariupol, I'm American. I butcher everything I say, man. But in the battle for Mariupol, in Azov Steel, there was talk about an American general being captured. And it was all over the place. They had the photograph of the guy. He's down. They got him. They captured him. Da, da, da. And I'm like, but people, he has a social media presence. And if you go follow him, you'll see that while he's supposed to be being taken prisoner here, he's actually given a speech here. And then he traveled here and gave a speech. And he exists. As do every member of NATO. They exist. They have families. They have social media presences. If you removed all of them at once, there would be a noticeable hole in NATO, which is not an infinite organization. It has limited specialists and specialties. And these people, when you're assigned to NATO, it's usually because you're a rising star in your relative service, which means people know who you are. You exist within your respective communities. And to suddenly be removed from those communities, people would notice. No one's talking about missing NATO officers because there are no missing NATO officers. They are all alive. They are all well. They are all doing their jobs. This is horseshit fantasy.
Arena in Moscow. We are waiting for you in Russia, Scott. Do you know the date when you will arrive in Moscow? I think a lot of people would like to come to meet you at the airport. And another question. Would you like to watch the parade and take part in the celebration of the great victory on May 9th? It's always a grand event.
Irina, thank you very much for the sentiment. It would be embarrassing if people came and meet me at the airport. But I do know the date. But look, let's get serious for a second. The Tatarsky assassination has sent a shockwave through my family. One of my daughters has opted not to come to Russia because she literally fears for her life, because I am listed on the Mirotvorets hit list. I'm the number one information terrorist in the eyes of the president of Ukraine, which means that my name on that list isn't just done for, shits and giggles. We have to assume that there's people who mean ill intent, and they've proven they can reach out and touch people in Moscow and now St. Petersburg. So rather than, concede or somehow yield to the intimidation tactics of the terrorists, we're gonna go. And I have nothing but the highest confidence in the people of Russia and indeed the people, my hosts, that nothing bad will happen. But one of the ways that you avoid bad things happening is you don't give the opposition too much opportunity. So we're keeping the schedule close hold. It's a book tour. There's no secret about that. And one of the goals, I hope, of the publisher is to sell books. So in order to do that, there has to be some sort of advance notice. And so they're in charge of releasing the schedule as required. I'm totally giving that up to them because they've asked that. So, would I like to go to the May 9th ceremony? Who wouldn't? I don't think there's anybody. There's not a student of Russia. There's not somebody who understands what May 9th means to Russia who wouldn't want to be there. And if I was ever afforded the opportunity to be there, I would gladly attend because it would just be a spectacle of history. It would be emotional. It's the kind of stuff I wish America would do more of to honor the men and women who have served our country and honor them in a way that reflects the true love of a nation, not this superficial, put the yellow sticker on the back of a car, pretend that you support your veterans, but you don't. I think May 9th shows that Russia does support its veterans. Russia does remember. Russia will never forget. And so I would love to be part of that. And who knows? Maybe I will be.
I wonder if you can even get into airports in Russia without an airline ticket. I mean, isn't that what you need here in the U.S. now? Don't they let only people with a ticket inside?
I don't know, man. I guess.
You haven't been to hang out in an airport.
I have never been to Russia. I've been to the Soviet Union, but I have never been to Russia.
You can get into the terminal without a ticket, but you can't get beyond the entry area, same as in the U.S.
Oh, okay. So there may be an area where people could wait and greet you. All right. Sorry to disappoint, Arena. William from Derry, why do you think the front lines of Kherson and Zaporizhia haven't moved forward since November?
Because the Russians are on the defensive there. Because the Russians are busy killing tens of thousands of Ukrainians in the Bakhmut-Soledar complex. Because Russia is shaping the battlefield. The last I checked, Uledar is sort of in the Zaporizhia area, and there's been some movement forward there to engage the enemy, to pin them down, to have the Ukrainians commit reserves. You know, the battle will unfold the way the battle unfolds. But I just think it's absurd to sit there and talk about, you know, why hasn't it done X, Y, and Z without acknowledging why the Russians withdrew from the right bank of Kherson to begin with, because it was an untenable situation. They withdrew so that they wouldn't have 30,000 troops put in harm's way, so they wouldn't lose 3,000, 5,000 guys in a battle that didn't need to be fought. So that tells you that Russia isn't going to fight a battle until it needs to be fought. And right now, from the Russian perspective, which I have to respect, they don't believe that offensive operations in Kherson, Zaporizhia need to take place, especially when they're focused on a meat grinder operation in Bakhmut that has killed 32 to 38,000 Ukrainian soldiers. So that's why I don't think they're moving too fast in that area. But trust me, they will.
Next question comes from Walt in Missouri. With the beating of the war drum with China, James Madison's quotes are warning signs. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. And if tyranny and oppression come to this land, it will be in the guise of fighting a foreign enemy. What are your thoughts?
I agree totally. I take a look at the erosion of American civil liberties that have taken place in a time of perpetual warfare, especially post 9/11, when the United States Congress jammed through the Patriot Act. You know, nice name, because if you oppose the Patriot Act, you're unpatriotic. By definition, I didn't vote for the Patriot Act. What, you're not a patriot? You know, I mean, it's just clever the way to do it. People, a lot of people don't understand that almost the totality of the Patriot Act consisted of laws that had been tried to push through Congress before 9/11 by security-minded individuals and rejected by Congress as inherently undemocratic, unconstitutional, bad juju. After 9/11, packaged it all up. Nobody even read the damn thing. I mean, Michael Moore made the point of bringing it out. It's huge. Nobody read it. They all voted for it. Shoved down their throats. Now we have, you know, situations where they're getting ready to do things about the internet. You know, there's some laws on the book for that. They're attacking TikTok. They're doing everything they can to give the government unprecedented powers to surveil and monitor and interrupt, and now in the name of fighting disinformation, to terminate, to shut you down, to eliminate dissent. So yeah, James Madison is a pretty prescient individual. People should listen to what he said and understand its application to the present times.
Adrian from Helsinki, how effective could the super carriers be in modern warfare, especially the American one, since the U.S. has the largest number of them?
Well, I mean, effective in what way? I think they're very effective, you know, mass graves. I think that the United States has decided to package 5,000 to 7,000 of its own citizens. Most of them are citizens. There's some guys in the military who aren't, but loyal people who serve the military. They've put them in a convenient place so that when a Chinese missile hits the carrier will sink and take them all down. The carrier is a legacy weapon. What I mean by that is the carrier, you know, the modern carrier battle group came into being in World War II. It was a very effective weapon then. It was effective in years afterwards. We saw it in Korea. We saw it in Vietnam. We saw it even in the Persian Gulf. But during the Cold War, there was a growing recognition that the carrier was not what it seemed to be. Had we ever fought a conflict with the Russians, one of the scenarios was the Russians would come out with a massive wave of aircraft that would basically cycle off cruise missiles that would overwhelm the carrier battle group's ability to defend and sink the carrier. And every time we did a war game, that's what happened, because no matter how many Sea Whizzes and all this stuff, Aegis and everything we put out there, it would just get overwhelmed by the amount of missiles the Russians would be sending. But today it's not about the quantity, but the quality, especially in China, which now has, you know, these ballistic missiles, very precise ballistic missiles, hypersonic maneuvering warheads that are designed to kill aircraft carriers and the ships around them. And if the Chinese fire enough of them, then they'll get hit. And, you know, we just had the Chinese defense minister go to Moscow and meet with Vladimir Putin and Shoigu, and they talked about enhanced cooperation. I would bet a dime to a dollar that Russia is selling China Zircon and Kinzhal missiles, hypersonic missiles. One's fired from a ship or a submarine, the other one's a launch from an airplane. And you know, these are battle tested, proven systems. And you give those to the Chinese, and it's just a death knell for carriers. So, yeah.
The carriers. I wonder if the service members who are on that ship feel just as vulnerable as you say they are. Have you thought about that?
The smart ones do.
That goes back to what you were saying to the father and queens. You just got to follow orders.
Well, not really. I mean, it's not just follow orders. I mean, there's nothing that says the lieutenant can't write a paper for Naval Proceedings magazine and says that, you know, the carrier battle group is dead. Why are we continuing to do this? And you begin the revolution from below. I mean, the Marine Corps did that in the 1980s. The junior officers were in revolt against the old Vietnam War era tactics. We were like, maneuver warfare, baby, maneuver warfare. We bought it. We drank the Kool-Aid. We put the tin hats on. We were running around doing that. And enough of us came together where the Marine Corps changed. We had Al Gray, the commandant, who went, yeah. And, you know, General Berger today, he's the one who said the old Marine Amphibious Ready Group is a legacy system for the same reason. He said, we're not going to take a big ship with lots of Marines, sail it towards an enemy shore, only to have it sunk with all the Marines dead. So he said, that's not how we operate now. We're breaking it down into penny packets. We're going to swarm you with smaller ships. Yeah, you may get one or two of them, but we're going to get enough people on shore that we can do our job. New thinking. So no, I you know, the military survives by having good people in it, innovative people in it, thinking people in it. So yeah, it's not just shut up and do what you're told. It's think and try to change a system, especially when the system's broke. But if nobody listens to you, you still have to obey the orders.
Right, right, right. Well, it seems like there should be an argument about that. What's going on here? Harry from Leuven, a regular. He always comes up with good questions. Hello, Harry. Slovakia, Hungary, and Poland recently banned the import of Ukrainian grain. What kind of implications does this have?
Well, the Ukrainian grain, the problem is Ukraine is just a corrupt nation, fundamentally corrupt nation. The Ukrainian grain that's currently on the market is what they call technical grain. That means that it's used to produce alcohol for industrial purposes and things of that nature. It's not meant to be consumed. But the Ukrainians, because they are fundamentally corrupt, have been marketing this technical grain as consumption grain. And, it's grain that is rotten. It's already began fermenting. Much of it has certain toxic chemicals associated with it. And it's basically gutted the economic viability of the Polish, Hungarian, and I think, what was the other one, Slovakian farmers who've said, we want to get our hey, look at that. I got all three of them right. They want to get their grain to the market. So they've their governments have said, we're cutting it off so that we can have our farmers survive. We're not willing to sacrifice our farmers for Ukrainian grain, which is just crap to begin with. Right now, the European Union is desperately trying to come up with a solution that makes everybody happy. But again, coming up with a solution when you have to deal with the corruption that's endemic in Ukraine is almost impossible. And until Europe recognizes the reality that Ukraine is a rotten ship, and the best thing to do with Ukraine is to scuttle it and sink it. You know, they're not coming up with solutions. They're just exacerbating existing problems because you're pretending that Ukraine is something that it isn't. That is a straightforward, trustworthy, law-abiding nation that has the interests of the community at heart. Ukraine only cares about Ukraine. That's it.
All right, let's take one more of the questions submitted in advance. And by the way, those of you who got bounced emails, I think our problem is fixed, so sorry about that. Go to scottritterextra.com and click on Ask the Inspector if you want to submit questions for upcoming episodes. And Kevin Michalitzi is curating some live questions as they come in on YouTube and Facebook, and we'll get to those in a couple of minutes. S. Anderson, remember S., Scott? We used to get weekly questions from S. S. is back. The Ukrainian government is hinting at ceding western regions of Ukraine to Poland in exchange for Polish assistance in retaking Crimea. Is this the inane rambling of a desperate president, or is Zelensky that delusional?
Yes and yes. No, this is a stupid look. It's an act of desperation. Zelensky recently went to Poland, and my understanding is they had some conversations about creating a legal structure that that would result in some form of political and economic union between Ukraine and Poland, basically eliminating the border. But this would only take place once the conflict ended, because there's, you know, Poland needs to understand that if you eliminate the border while Russia's at war with Ukraine, you just made it so that Russia's at war with Poland too. And NATO won't go along with that, and Poland can't act outside of the framework of NATO on something of this nature. So it's pure fantasy, just drivel. And again, people need to understand when they say, you know, Ukraine take Crimea, what part of Russia will use nuclear weapons to prevent an existential threat to the Russian motherland? And Ukraine is, Crimea is the Russian motherland, and any effort to retake Crimea, especially one backed by Poland and other NATO nations, would be seen as an existential threat to Russia, which would require the appropriate response, which would probably be the targeting either through precision-guided conventional weapons or nuclear weapons of NATO decision-making centers. So it's, in effect, suicide. But Zelensky is clearly a man who's lost control of his faculties. He's desperate. He's delusional. And you know, but that I understand. What I don't understand is the Poles, who somehow think that they are God's gift to Central Europe and that they have a God-given right to expand their borders and become some sort of Central Europe superpower that everything revolves, you know, that the fantasy that Ukrainians have that, you know, the world centers around Ukraine has been transferred to the Poles now, and the Poles think the world centers around Poland. It's just, it's wishful thinking, it's fantasy, it has hopefully nothing to do with reality, but you never know. Desperate people do desperate things in desperate times, and we are in desperate times, so we'll see.
Okay, unless we figure something out, which we might, but we haven't so far, well, we're not going to be able to get the autographed books to you during the month of May while Scott is in Russia, but maybe we'll figure something out. But if you want to make sure you get an autographed book, get your order in now before Scott departs for Russia at the end of the month, and you can go to scottrittermerch.com for that. And also we have an Ask the Inspector t-shirt. And that was designed to buy a little time for Kevin Michalitzi, who has some questions coming to us live from Facebook and YouTube.
But if he doesn't, oh, there it is.
Why, did you want to say something else, Scott?
I was just going to say the last day I'll be able to mail books is Friday the 28th. So if I receive an order before then, I will do everything in my power to autograph the book, package it up, get it to the post office, and get it in. Anything that comes in after that doesn't mean you're not going to get a book. It just means that you're not going to get a book until June.
Okay. Germany is shutting down its nuclear power. How the hell are these people supposed to fight Russia or China? This question coming from Moondragon on YouTube.
I don't know. The ongoing comedy show that is Germany is stunning at a time when the decisions of their leadership to turn their back on Russian energy and thereby putting Germany into a national energy crisis. They continue to have this fantasy of clean energy and of meeting certain benchmarks. And key to that is the shutting down of I think it was the last three nuclear power plants in Germany. So, I mean, sometimes you just got to laugh. It's sort of the equivalent of watching somebody climb up a tree and sit on a limb and pull out a saw and start sawing the branch between them and the trunk of the tree. And you're going, dude, that ain't going to work the way you think it's going to work. But sometimes you just have to sit back and let it happen. And so that's what we're doing. We're watching Germany saw off the branch that they're sitting on, and there will be a fall.
Okay. Next question coming in on YouTube and Facebook is from Sparky. Thanks a lot for the donation, Sparky. Do they not have church in the service anymore? When I was at Fort Bragg in the 1980s, we had a rabbi as a chaplain. Surely they still have a church.
Oh, no, they have church services in every battalion. Well, again, I don't know what goes on today because I'm not in the military today, but my understanding is because I talked to some active duty chaplains. First of all, when you are a military chaplain, you are imbued with multi-denominational powers. And what that means is in combat, you can give last rites, or you're trained to do things that respect the religious needs of the soldiers and Marines and sailors under your command. So you can do last rites. You can treat bodies. It's the way, Muslims would, or Jewish people would, et cetera. So it's there. And there are religious services. Oftentimes a Christian chaplain will be assisted, and he will help organize Muslim services that are headed up by a Muslim soldier under his commander or Marine, so that there's respect, but he'll make sure that it's done properly in accordance with the military's, standards for the conduct of religious services, et cetera. But no, I mean, the military, at least till recently, continues to be a very conservative organization that has full respect for the religious beliefs of the members, and they have chaplains assigned at the battalion level, at least, and who that's their job, to look out for the spiritual needs of the men and women in the command.
Yeah, what you said before, which might have confused this person, is only that an Orthodox Jew couldn't take the Sabbath off, but they could otherwise.
You can observe Sabbath. I mean, but what I mean is, as long as it's the same thing. Battle for Iwo Jima. The Japanese are up there, dudes. The war ain't stopping. But you want to take mass? There can be a pause in the combat if your unit is no longer actively engaged, and they will hold mass. And there's famous photographs of Marines taking mass in the middle of the battle for Iwo Jima. And they were marched in. The chaplain did his service, gave mass, then they were marched straight up to the battlefield. The military will bend over backwards to make sure that you are given an opportunity within reason. But
well, yeah, you say observe, but the way it's typically observed is it's a 24-hour period. I think what you're saying is you can't take 24 hours off. Some abbreviated version. Yeah.
You are not going to get a day-long pass on Sabbath if every you're in week. The military. Anytime. Yeah. I mean, if you take leave and you're not in combat, that's your business. But no, generally speaking,
was Father Mulcahy in MASH, was that a realistic character, would you say? You remember Father Mulcahy?
I would say that a lot of times chaplains are very unique personalities because they can afford to be unique. I mean, they go through a chaplain school. They have certain abilities and responsibilities to to tend to the needs of the troops. And also, I think today now, especially with various, if there's any harassment of that nature, the chaplains are a accepted vehicle for receiving complaints of this nature.
All right. I'll take that as a yes. Next question, Kevin, what do you got? Let's do a couple more questions before we call it a show. Linda McGregor, one of our regulars. Hi, Linda. Scott, will the Russians take Odessa now?
Look, Vladimir Putin made it clear that he was focused solely on restoring the economic and social well-being of the territories that Russia absorbed. Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Luhansk. He made no reference to any other territories, and Russia has not articulated any ambition to do so. But Dmitry Medvedev, on the other hand, Vladimir Putin's attack dog, he has made it clear that Ukraine's continued resistance will probably manifest itself in additional loss of territories. And I think that's the direction that Russia's heading. If Ukraine doesn't avail itself of the opportunity to negotiate an end to this conflict, then Russia will end the conflict on its terms. And those terms might be rather harsh. And they might incorporate taking over territories like Odessa, Dnipropetrovsk, Kharkov.
Okay. I know, Scott, you said you have an appointment right after this, but let's try to...
No, we're good. We're good. We're good. We're good.
All right, two more questions. Go ahead, Kevin. Best von Slafhofen. Come on. Mr. Ritter, help us here understand this. Whenever Russia or another country suggests peace talks, the first immediate response is America will not or never agree on any peace talks with Russia or anyone else. Seriously? The war's in Ukraine, not America. What happens if the Ukraine people say it's enough, we want peace? Does America intend to tell people of the Ukraine, tough, the war continues? Your options. Thoughts on this, Mr. Ritter. An excellent program. Yes, best. And you got yourself a fine name as well.
I mean, of course, Ukraine can make decisions on its own. But I think we have to understand that Ukraine has sold its soul to the devil. Ukraine is deeply in debt. And if Ukraine walks away from its American and European sponsors and seeks to go its own path towards conflict resolution with Russia, the Americans and the Europeans may say, well, then you're on your own. And all that $150 billion of debt you've accrued, you got to pay the piper. The other thing is the war would end. The German defense minister said something that for once I agree with, and that is the moment Europe and the United States stop providing military assistance to Ukraine, the war ends. And that's just the God's honest truth. And so, you know, most people want to negotiate from a position of strength, or at least perceived strength. And if Ukraine wants to negotiate with the Russians, there's a perception that if the Russians don't agree, that Ukraine could continue the fight. And if the United States and Germany aren't there guaranteeing the continued provision of support, then Ukraine will collapse instantly. And so there's a balancing act there. The other thing is there's issues of principle. That the United States has said that Crimea and these four territories will never be considered part of Russia. And if Ukraine negotiates a peace that gives that away and concedes this to Russia, then that puts the United States in a difficult position of trying to be more Ukrainian than the Ukrainians. And the United States wants to make sure that its policies conform to whatever peace or whatever peace is negotiated conform to the policies of the United States. Now, that's a mistaken belief on the United States that Russia is going to give two hoots for anything that the United States wants out of this conflict. But that's the pressure that's being put on Ukraine right now. So that's why Ukraine really can't move forward independently. They will, until until it's too late, until there literally is no ability to continue to struggle, Ukraine will be beholden to the wishes of its American masters.
All right, let's get one more question in, Kevin. The Wolf of Belgium, do you think Europe should fear Russian cyber attacks more than bombings?
Yeah, I do. I mean, cyber attacks are real. They happen. The Russians have a very clever way of doing it so that it's disguised as a non-state actor. They've done a hell of a job here in the United States, knocking out some capabilities, sending a signal that they could do more. And if Europe wants to play games, they play stupid games, you get stupid prizes. Sometimes a stupid prize might be Russia shutting things down. Russia understands, though, that cyber is a two-way street, and that if they shut you down, that you can shut them down. And that's why I don't think you've seen concerted Russian efforts. I mean, there's things taking place behind the scenes, as any intelligence service with the cyber capability does, to infiltrate, to collect intelligence, et cetera. But the key to intelligence collection is not to let the enemy know you're doing it. So if it's happening right now, that means Europe doesn't know it's happening and the Russians are collecting intelligence, or maybe the European security people have successfully blocked the attack, but because of the gentleman's rule, they just aren't talking about because they're getting blocked by the Russians. I mean, it's the intelligence game, guys. It is a game. It's taking place. But the chance of Russia bombing, if Russia starts bombing Europe, then we're all in deep trouble, because that's just one stage away from going critical. Cyber attacks have been taking place. They are taking place, and they're going to continue to take place.
Okay, the next edition of Ask the Inspector will be Sunday night this week instead of Friday night, and also Sunday, that would be at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And also our other podcast, Scenes from the Evolution, will be Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks to all in the audience who watched. Thanks to everybody who donated. Scott, you're pointing to this question.
Yeah, I just say, hey, Matthew, Krasnaya... God, yeah, not trust me, Vesta, not the Red Star. Komsomolskaya Pravda is the publisher. It's a major publisher in Russia, and I would assume that they have a website, and that you can order the book from that website. I will endeavor to find out how books can be purchased. I've also been told that this book is going to be given good treatment, meaning that if you go to a bookstore, it should be, you know how you, in America, when you go to Barnes and Nobles, when, you know, Hillary Clinton writes her, you know, $5 million advanced book on nothing, how they stack it up in the front so everybody sees it as they walk in. Well, my non $5 million book about nothing, actually, it's a good book, is going to be stacked up in the front, or at least in an area where people will be able to see it. So I imagine that if you, for at least a period of time, maybe the month of May, you should be able to walk into a Russian bookstore and see the book, find the book. But I will also see if there's a web page and get it out to you on that.
Okay, and thanks to Kevin Michalitzi for handling the backstage duties. And take care, everybody. See you soon.